Austin, if you'd come forward and invite... we only have one mic here, so it's helpful if you speak through the microphone because people hear better. So invite people to come forward and state your name and brief question or comment, and then have Austin comment. So please come and speak.
Austin, thank you. It's nice to,
teeth aren't that great.
Nice to see you after all these years. My name is Van Christou. Thank you, Austin, for that lovely delivery. You touched on a number of things that are really interesting to me. One of them was you talked about the statistics of schizophrenics and the statistics of bipolar people. Maybe you could elaborate on the difference between schizophrenia and the bipolar thing in relation to its characteristics in people.
Well, schizophrenia comprises a whole grouping of symptoms, including but not excluding hearing voices, paranoia, problems with socialization, reduced ability to read body language. Now, that's the whole section of schizophrenia. Now, bipolar, the bipolar concept, is related to mood swings, and from manic to depressive. So everybody knows what it is to be depressed. Manic, in the manic phase, some people can actually hear voices that are bipolar. When they're in a manic phase, they get very agitated. They might not sleep for several days. In many cases, they have addictions problems. They are very good workers, actually. Some employers actually like people with bipolar because they can work straight through. They can do two shifts without batting an eye. And then they cycle up and down. But the thing is that today the concept of schizophrenia and bipolar is melded. It's like along a spectrum from bipolar to schizophrenia. So you have people placed all along that line. So you have now a definition called schizoaffective, which is some manic depressive bipolar characteristics and some people with schizophrenia. So the two in combination, some of each one. So it's not a clear cut. Like when you break a leg, you know, or have your teeth capped, you know that that is capped. You can look at it and define it, and it's clearly understandable. With mental illness, it's a lot less definable. We're not at a point yet today where they can do an MRI and say you have schizophrenia or say you have bipolar. They can say maybe you have it. You have some of the characteristics like enlarged ventricles in the brain. Those are the areas of fluid movement. You might have reduced prefrontal cortex blood flow. There might be changes to your limbic parts of your brain. But they're not at a stage now where they understand the difference.
My name's Nancy Brown, and my question is, how much of the non-compliance or the reluctance to take medication would be due to the side effects of it?
Well, side effects are very big, but I honestly believe that most of... the mic's not on. Can you hear me now? Hello, can you hear me now? The, what was the... I'm too tall.
I think you just have to shout.
Just shout. What was the question again? I'm sorry. Oh, the side effects, yeah. Now, the side effects are that, for example, with the medications, you can get weight gain, massive weight gain. Obviously, I wasn't this way when I was 30. And also, sexual problems, metabolic changes to your body, which can cause diabetes. So these are very serious things. But then in life, one has to make difficult choices. When I talked to my doctor about the sexual problems, he said, my GP said, not the psychiatrist, the psychiatrist just would evade it, but the GP said, oh, that's what Viagra's for. And so, you know, these things can be compensated for, just like anything. And life is full of difficult choices, but I believe the non-compliance comes from stigma, that people, society stigma against it, people feel that if they don't take their medication, then therefore they are no longer ill. There's always this pattern of people... people not taking their medication because they're all of a sudden are normal now, so they don't have to take it any longer. So that's a pattern. So it seems to be more, once you can come to acceptance, you can accept a lot of side effects. Many medications have a lot of side effects. The SSRIs for depression can cause impotence and weight gain. Many heart medications cause very serious problems. And other medications cause other problems. Anyone that takes medication knows they all have side effects. But I believe it's that stigma that distinguishes why people don't take medication.
I don't want to move it in case we knock it down and we won't get it going up again.
We can work with you.
There we go. Clearly, my battle from now on, I don't suppose there's anybody now this... Talk about ego. I was just about to say I don't suppose there's anybody in the room that doesn't know who I am, but anyway, I am Bridget Pasteur. My battle now is your battle, Austin, is how do we get this government to actually recognize that there's a problem? Because they'll give some words to it, and they'll give some money to the homeless, but what they don't really say or acknowledge is that, yes, we should care for those that need care. They don't use the word care. It's always termed and couched in business terms. So my job will be to be able to make them say, yes, there has to be a caring component, and yes, we have to learn how to put a dollar figure on that caring component so that it goes into the big budget. And it's people like you, Austin, that will have to lead the battle, because you can say you've been there and done that, and it's very, very important. But the other thing is that, I don't think I've got a question, sorry about that. No, I just wanted to ask Austin if he agrees that this is where some of our thrust has to be, and people like you to write letters and start using the word care, and because they only understand dollars, use care and dollars in the same sort of thing, like how do we put a dollar figure on it? But also with the homeless part, Austin, I'd really like to have you comment a little bit further on how do we, again, get the government to recognize that supports are imperative, that a roof over your head isn't the answer.
Well, when I was... yeah, you can applaud now. Although she was applauded by getting elected. So, so basically... you know, with the revisions to the Mental Health Act, obviously the government does know there is a major problem with the system, you know. Now, how they're going to deal with it is really up to them and the new government. But as far as homelessness, in Edmonton, the people that they're bringing in from New York, all of a sudden they started talking about supported, you know, in the housing. They were just talking about housing first, just bricks and mortar, but now they're actually talking, and it was in the paper. You probably saw that in the Edmonton Journal. So apparently they are hearing the message from people outside of Alberta. So I believe that they understand that support has to go with. If it was, I don't know, do you have problems with crack houses in Lethbridge? Yeah, you do? Well, if you think about it, crack houses are low-income houses. Obviously, the government doesn't want to set up crack houses for addicts that are homeless. So there has to be support. There has to be some form of treatment, or else you'll get a duplication of already existing social ills. So you have to have that continuity. that treatment. Now, whatever form it takes, for example, you might argue that case management, these get into the intricacies of social work and nursing, case management versus assertive community treatment, assertive treatment teams. You know, then you get into the debate. But I believe that the government, and I've been told by people that are more in the know, is understanding, beginning to understand, because they've been told from outside of the province, that support is necessary for the housing initiative to go through. If it was just bricks and mortar, it would be very simple. I wish it was that simple, but it involves medical treatment. It really does.
I am Malgura, and Bridget spoke about the government. My question is, how much public awareness is there about this issue? And if it's not enough, what are we doing about it? That's my question. And I know there's not enough awareness, as I understand, going door to door to door, and the public doesn't know what's happening.
Well, I see, I'm just looking at the executive director of the local Schizophrenia Society, Diane Herrick. So the Schizophrenia Society, provincially and in the various regions they serve also, is there anyone from Canadian Mental Health here? No? Canadian Mental Health also does a lot of work. ADAC and various groups like Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Cocaine Anonymous, do work in the field, in some cases government supported, in some cases like AA and NA, non-government supported. I do know that the Marion Center, which is a charity in Edmonton that is a Catholic lay charity, serves food and provides support to homeless people and low-income people in Edmonton, has seen, I believe, a triple, I'm not sure, I don't want to be quoted on this, either two or three times increase in the last two or three years in the number of people they serve lunch to in Edmonton. So, you know, all of this is percolating up and people are beginning to get an impression that something seems to be wrong. I don't think it's entirely a problem of the boom, you know. It's some of it has to do with NIMBY, not in my backyard. Some of it has to do with problems of construction, zoning requirements for buildings. The bricks and mortar side has to do with that. But, you know, basically to end homelessness, you'll need, I'll give you an example. In New York, they had a campaign for homelessness, end homelessness. They had a 75% success rate because they combined community treatment orders, which is enforced treatment, and risperidol consta at the same time. Now, some people can take risperidol. They have to take Floenzol or they have to take a tablet. They had a 75% success rate because they attached the two. They would also, people, when they would get their federal disability checks, would have to go in and get an injection if they were homeless. Now, I proposed at one point that there be a steak certificate, a certificate for a steak dinner that you would give somebody when they get their injection. And many people would come in for the steak dinner to get the injection. That might seem a little bit facile, but this is similar to what they're doing in New York, which is tying up the checks to treatment. Now, I don't know if you can legally do that. Bridget would be more of an expert than I would. But, you know, you have to think constructively. And it doesn't necessarily involve that much more expenditure of money. It just involves trying to efficiently use existing resources. Because resources, especially in the large urban centers, are going to extra police cars for the homeless. Extra, there's at least, somebody told me, an extra ambulance equivalent full-time that is devoted to homeless people. I was surprised when I heard that. So that's a lot of money that, if it was directed in terms of prevention, might allay the problem. before it actually happens.
Just before I ask that question, I'd actually like to comment on just the area of the education and how that relates to the governance that is involved in the area of schizophrenia. I think one of the areas that we're lacking is just more educational funding for being able to educate more people in the area of medicine and the area of research. You know, coming from a psychology student at the University of Lethbridge, I know that there's huge competition for people that are very much eager and passionate about the field of mental illness, but because there's such little money available to educate students, such little funding from the government to educate us to become qualified, I think that's a big problem for being able to help in terms of scholarships, in terms of more people getting educated to be able to help do research on how to, just in terms of making progress in the area of schizophrenia or other mental illnesses. So I think, you know, that's a major problem. You know, being in a rich province and paying like the highest tuition makes it very difficult for people like us to be able to go on, even though we're passionate about it. So I think that's just something I think to comment on. But my question, which is heavy off topic, is how is it like in a marital situation when you have schizophrenia? I mean, for yourself, it seems like you've been very successful with that, but in terms of other people that you've seen?
Well, I believe the statistics are about 10% of people with schizophrenia are married at any one point. And I was married before, my first marriage, to a woman that had psychotic depression, which is basically schizophrenia. And she decided to go off her medications and became homeless for several years in Hong Kong. She just ran out of the country and refused to help. She actually sent back her $10,000 a year pension and seized it. So she had literally no money coming in. This is after she divorced me. And so I do know that it involves, any relationship involves compromise. If a person has diabetes, my wife says she would rather be with a person with schizophrenia that takes their medication and has the occasional quirky thing like thinking Caesar's is by hand than being a diabetic who consumes sugar or doesn't take their insulin correctly. That it's the choice you make. And, you know, when you are in a relationship, you have to make certain choices. Even if one is, you know, some of the people here probably mean a lot more experienced with this than I am. But thing is that the medication does have certain sexual side effects, but those can be compensated for, if that was the question. As far as, that's usually the question that they ask when my wife and I are up here. One time we were talking to some drug reps, and that's, they looked very antsy, and that was the question they wanted to ask. And that, you know, and you can adapt to problems and stuff. The other thing is that I gave the first partnership program. That's an educational program by the Schizophrenia Society that goes into schools and universities to give talks from people with schizophrenia and sometimes a family member in 1993. And there have been thousands of speeches given since then. I've personally given about 200 of them. And really, the educational program, in my belief, should focus towards the high school students because that's when it first appears in males and just a little bit after that in females. And if you can get those kids to understand that if they get treatment immediately or they have a friend that's tripping out, if they get treatment, then their ultimate prognosis will be better, as they know. But the earlier the treatment you get, the better your long-term prognosis. If you let it go on for 5 years, there's effects to the brain and obviously disruptions to your life. So I believe that any educational program shouldn't be targeted towards adults, I mean, with some adults, or university students, because it's already too late, should be targeted towards later elementary and junior high and high school students, because that's the group where it first appears. And I've noticed, I've actually had people, there was one girl in particular came to me 5 years after I gave a talk at her high school, and she got schizophrenia, and because I had given this talk, when she got it, she wasn't afraid to go seek help. So that was one case of somebody whose life could have been destroyed. I mean, it was affected, but it could have been completely shattered, who sought help because of this educational program. And you could imagine if it was part of the curriculum, the health curriculum specifically, that would be the answer, the health curriculum in high school.
Hi, it's me again. I don't want to hog this, but I've just had a note passed to me by one of my staff people. And this is interesting that it fits in with what we're talking about. Schizophrenia Society scheduled meetings with MLAs throughout the province because their grant applications were turned down. Now, what happens with grant applications is that hardly anybody ever knows about it because it's all paper. So I think what has to happen is that when some of these grant applications go forward, maybe we should be going to the community to sign petitions that would back up those grants. Because let me tell you, they're all looked at in the back rooms and they just go, yes, no, yes, no, and you'll probably never know why. And then you have to turn around, and it's all about flipping paper around. And we were talking at our table about huge bureaucracies, and I think that's what supports our bureaucracies, are all these grant programs. So, Austin, I'm hoping that my question is, Austin, don't you think that we should be getting part of society behind some of our grants? And do you rely on grants in your job, or are you actually, supported by the Schizophrenia Society?
Well, I serve on the Premier's, I'm actually a minor government functionary, on the Premier's Council on the Status of Persons with Disabilities for the last 3 years. And I'm on AISH, and because I've come to a point where I realize that I can't work full-time. Anytime I've tried to reintegrate back beyond about 5 to 10 hours, I've had various jobs totaling about 5 to 10 hours at a time, that it was too much. My voices would start increasing. The doctor would have to increase the dosage levels. So it becomes a point when if you're working and you have to increase your dosage to work, it becomes counterproductive. So now what I do is I give the occasional speech. I write a lot, some with my father, and try to live a productive life. Now, I'm not paid to do what I do, but I believe that I'm given the opportunity to be on AISH, so it's necessary to give something back. And many people on AISH do volunteer, and you'd be surprised. If people on AISH were to stop volunteering, many charities would grind to a screeching halt because of the amount of input that they give. So I believe that it's important to give back to society in whatever capacity one can. Some people can to a greater, some to a lesser extent. And, I mean, my medication does cost $12,000 a year. So
I personally bring the constitutional makeup. My name is Dave Ebert. I believe the constitutional makeup of humanity is family. I used to have a schizophrenic work with me. He wasn't homeless. His dad and mom had him at home. And I think as long as it is possible, when somebody has schizophrenia, it would be really, I think the parents would love the children enough to keep them, even if they have schizophrenia. I realize in time they may have to go somewhere else. But this fellow worked for me. He was a schizophrenic. Yes, he had his problems, but he had a home. His parents had him in their home. Doesn't that make sense?
Well, I do agree that, it's incumbent on the families to support, but one has to question, could my father, who's 80 years old on a limited pension, have supported me for all these years? How many people, and these are disabilities, would there be a question if the person had no legs? if the person had one arm? What is the distinction between a brain injury, and this is an organic problem of the brain, and these other disabilities, which are recognized as limiting your capacity to support yourself? Before, in two or three generations ago, the solution was for the government to incarcerate the mentally ill. That was how what society as a whole dealt with mental illness. You were brought into the asylums, and thousands of people lived at Pinoca. Thousands of people lived in Alberta Hospital. But society as a whole decided that this was not good. This was a decision that was made before me. This was a decision that was made because it was felt that a life, however marginal and limited in society, was better than being warehoused. And in many cases, family members are at the end of their rope. You know, could Diane support her father? You know, I mean, I wish it was so easy to just rely on family. Could you, do you live with your daughter, sir? You do? She lives with you? Yeah. What happens when you go?
She looks after whatever's left
over. Yeah, well, if your brain is broken, you might not be able to, she might not, if she had schizophrenia, she might end up homeless. And this is something, and I know this, is facing people that are my age with the illness, and their parents are saying, well, when I die, I believe that my child will commit suicide. And I've had two people, parents, say that to me in the last 6 months. Because, I mean, if it was so simple, you don't go to your family to convalesce after a heart surgery, do you? You go to a heart specialist. You go to occupational therapy, rehabilitation therapy. It's the same with a mental illness. You need medical supports and social supports. It's just that it's complicated by the fact that it's part of our mind. It's part of our personality. I wish it was so simple to just have families supporting. Families are important. Obviously, my dad's here, so families are important. Okay.
Well, definitely need to put it down. I never thought of myself as short. Oh, that's going to fall. I'll go tippy toes. Two things I want to say. First is, and perhaps you comment on, first is I'm always frustrated when I hear the term schizophrenics as opposed to people with schizophrenia. Or, you know, we talk about lepers as opposed to people with leprosy, because it seems to me it dehumanizes and depersonalizes when we just name a person by the condition. The other thing I wanted to ask you about, though, is the stigma that is attached to any kind of mental illness. And as you were speaking, I was remembering how Rosalind Carter, and if you'll know Jimmy Carter's wife, spoke out very strongly about mental illness and was shut down. She was told it was not a, wasn't a sexy issue, and that she should take on something a little more, you know, interesting to the general public. I see people nodding. They remember this. And it seems to me that people that have type 2 diabetes, most of which can be prevented through health and exercise and whatnot, diet, should be more ashamed in some ways, and I'll put that word in quotation marks, than people with a mental illness. They have nothing they've caused on their own. So it seems to me that really the stigma should be against these things that we can prevent, you know, lung cancer from smoking and type 2 diabetes and on and on and on, as opposed to mental illness, which we didn't do anything to cause.
Well, first to discuss, I get into trouble with the Schizophrenia Society, as Diane's looking at me. They say person with schizophrenia. My attitude is that obviously in many of your generations, homosexuality has changed within the perception of society. To be called gay now is not the same stigma it was 50 years ago or even 20 years ago. That it's not a matter of the word, it's how people perceive it. So what should change is For example, Kramer. How many of you know Seinfeld? Kramer, the guy Kramer, the real person that it's based on, is a manic depressive. He's bipolar. And the character, if you think about it, Kramer is pretty mentally ill. If you had funny situations where people are built up in the media, so you had a funny, quirky, schizophrenic. I was at a conference in Banff, and this same question that came up about stigma and how do we prevent it. I said, well, on Carnation Street, there should be a quirky, schizophrenic young, maybe one of the kids gets it, you know, and then that would educate the populace. And that's how people get educated. You can look at it on the short term, but I do honestly believe that, I mean, there's talk about changing the name of schizophrenia to another name, that really you have to change the way people perceive it. And you do that by giving talks in schools, by people like me getting up here and telling everybody their dirty washing. And you do this over and over again, and eventually societal perceptions will change. Now, what was the second part of the question? The stigma that's attached to it. You know, the thing is that, ironically, nobody thinks anything about supporting people that are developmentally delayed. You know, there would be no question, you know, that those people with that disability get support from the government. There's never a batted eye. If they're not wandering the streets homeless. But this other disability that affects people in their youth, usually much earlier than I got it. I got it at the age of 30. They're perceived as different. They're saying, well, they chose that. It's their family's problem. It's not our collective problem. But, I mean, we do live in a society that if we could solve the problem of homelessness like they did 100 years ago, but I don't believe that would be satisfactory. I honestly don't.
Let's see if they have one more question.
Gary, mine's not a question, but it's a comment, but it's related. Can I ask Val Buller to stand up, and can I ask Bridget to stand up? Bridget, would you stand? At our table, we discussed this problem. We also discussed the problem of government. We have just finished having an election. It's been critical that we have good candidates for that election and good people get elected. And two people who stood for election threw their hat into the ring and put their name before the people to be elected deserve our praise. This is a council of public affairs, and these people are contributing very directly to the public process, especially the process which we talked about today. So on your behalf, can I just say to them, thank you for being candidates.
Gordon, I declare you thoroughly off subject. Was there one final question you wanted to ask before we close? We'll give you... Okay, Michael, you come forward, and would you come here and go... Two quick questions, two quick answers.
I just want to say, nothing that I've said is partisan. If you examine what I've said, if you ask Bridget, none of it's partisan. I was referred in the legislature by both parties.
Michael.
Just some comments. The word dignity comes into my mind very often. I worked in mental health for 36 years. I've dealt with people like Austin and many others. And the biggest problem that I have seen is that we increase the stress on them totally unnecessarily. Unfortunately, money is a necessary evil. And we give them not even half the amount required to live decently. Like, it costs about $30,000 on minimum here in Canada. We're in the richest country in the world outside of Saudi Arabia. And sitting on all kinds of resources, and we can't give them a decent... They get about $14,000 on age. You tell me And I'd like to keep this before people all the time, because otherwise we can all get very complacent as we improve our situation and forget what it's like when we were struggling ourselves. We need to keep that in mind and push our representatives, and especially now, given the situation that we have since Monday, let's not forget it. Just a little plug on your behalf and on behalf of people with those kind of challenges.
Maybe we'll take a second question. Would you like to ask your question, and then we'll let them respond?
My name is Jack Dick. And Austin, I think you covered this subject from your point very well, and have done probably a lot of research. My question is, where is the best, most reliable coverage being done for people that we're talking about today within the world? Is in other parts of Canada or some other country on the other side of the globe?
Well, actually, I have to keep this brief, but my psychiatrist is an internationally known researcher, and he said a WHO, World Health Organization, study compared different nations' expenditures and outcomes for mental illness treatment. And they actually found, which galls me, Cuba, of all places, has some of the best outcomes for the amount of money they spend. I think, that Japan was near the bottom. Cuba was near the top, and Japan was near the bottom, and Japan spends a multitude, several orders of magnitude, more than Cuba does. And it's not because of their ideology. It's because of their basic healthcare philosophy of prevention.
Absolutely.
Rather than reacting to crisis, try to prevent the crisis so then you don't have to. Now, the other comment about age, well, I believe I don't own a car. I don't have a cell phone. I don't have cable. I do have the internet. That's my one luxury. And I don't smoke. I'm willing to live within the amount of money that the government deems to give me. I mean, what the problem is that when rents go up to $1,000 a month, that something has to give.
Just going to take one more quick question.
So Diane is the staff person for the organization in town, and I'm going to give her the last final word.
Thank you. I just want to say that if you're looking for more information on schizophrenia, you can come to our office, or we can come to you there. We're here to answer your questions for you. And anybody that wants to write a letter of support for us so we get the grant money that we got turned down, call the Schizophrenia Society. We'd love to have you write a letter for us. Thanks.
And all of you for being part of this great discussion. Thank you. Next week we're on the animals and play and what makes for whole human beings.